They're that kid that won the scholarship to seminary school. Maybe they're the first in their family to go to college. They want to get married. They want to have kids. Or they say they'll leave the church. That's also an issue for the future of the Catholic Church here in Africa. It may not be mentioned here on this tour.
Well, the site for tomorrow's Mass is a slum in Nairobi. This Pope has made his compassion for the poor central to his papacy. How has that message been received there in Kenya?
Well, as we all know, this Pope is famously humble, but even Kenyans were shocked when he drove in from the airport in a little gray Honda. And Kenyan editorial writers noted what a far cry this vehicle was from the polished Mercedes and the tinted 4x4s favored by politicians here. And the timing for this visit, I think, is particularly interesting because corruption, I mean, that's long been an issue in this region, but the Pope's arrival in Kenya coincides with major government corruption allegations coming to light. And it's no coincidence that just days before the Pope's visit, the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, sacked five ministers accused of stealing public money. So there's a hope that the Pope can really accomplish something on this trip.
All right. Thanks very much, Greg.
Thanks, Renee.
NPR's Gregory Warner speaking to us from Nairobi, Kenya.
It's the topic many dread at the Thanksgiving table. Politics, it can be so divisive, which leads many to wonder, why can't our politicians compromise more often? NPR's Scott Detrow went in search of an answer.
The Syrian refugee crisis feels like just the latest high-profile news event where Republicans and Democrats seem to be living in parallel universes.
And the country has always been a place of refuge from those who are persecuted.
And I don't think orphans under five should be admitted into the United States at this point.
That was Washington Governor Jay Inslee speaking on NPR and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie on Hugh Hewitt's radio show. Of the 30 governors who voiced concerns about letting Syrian refugees into their states, all but one was Republican. As for the presidential campaign, well, here's a recent Republican presidential debate.
Who in Congress do you most admire on the Democratic side? I need one name from each of you. Let's start with Governor Jindal.
Look, we can waste our time.
None of the four candidates on stage answered the question. Hillary Clinton also punted on a similar question recently. All of this really bothers Ray LaHood, a longtime Republican congressman from Illinois who also served in President Obama's cabinet. LaHood recently wrote a book called Seeking Bipartisanship. He told public television station WTVP that Obama didn't do enough to reach across the aisle.
They could have said, hey, we're going after some Republicans. We're going to invite some Republicans down here for dinner and see what do you need for us to get this bill passed? What does it take?
I find people's bafflement about the failures of bipartisanship baffling.
That's Dartmouth political scientist Brendan Nyhan. He argues that competition between two political parties with two very different agendas is how American democracy works. Nyhan has a name for the wine and dine outreach approach that LaHood and so many others suggest as a fix for partisanship. He calls it the Green Lantern theory of the presidency.
Which is the idea that if the president only tried hard enough, he could get whatever it is he wants. It's based on the powers of a comic book hero.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight.
If he only tried harder, if he only reached out more, they would eventually fall at his feet and agree to his requests. There's just very little evidence to suggest that's the case.
But while parties have traditionally disagreed, the tone has shifted. A recent Pew study found that among partisan liberals and conservatives, very unfavorable views of the other side have more than doubled over the last 20 years. On top of that, says senior researcher Jocelyn Kiley,
they're more likely to give money, they're more likely to participate in the political system in a number of different ways.
And these same people, the ones with political clout, have also become much less likely to agree with anything the other party has to say. That means candidates are more often rewarded for sticking to their guns and punished when they don't. New Jersey's Chris Christie appeared alongside Obama after Hurricane Sandy struck his state in the weeks before the 2012 election. 3 years after the storm, Christie is still defending that appearance.
I shook his hand and I showed him respect.
So when that question of why politicians can't get along comes up at the Thanksgiving table, remind your family. These days, a Republican can't even shake a Democrat's hand during a major crisis without it becoming controversial. Scott Detrow, NPR News.
And there have been a lot of harsh words about Muslims on the presidential campaign trail, some of the sharpest from Republicans Donald Trump and Ben Carson. Many Muslims say the current political climate now feels worse than it did in the days just after 9/11, and they're frustrated with the Republican Party. As NPR's Asma Khalid reports, it wasn't always that way.
When I met with Seba Ahmed, she was wearing a headscarf and a traditional Pakistani outfit. She explained that her Islamic values seem more in sync with conservative American values.
I realized I aligned a lot more with the Republican Party. I was pro-life, pro-business, pro-trade, pro-traditional family values.
Ahmed is a Republican. She says Donald Trump is one of her top candidates, but she's frustrated with how he talks about Islam.
You know, shutting down mosques, putting IDs on Muslims. It's not even about being politically correct. It's about basic human dignity.
These days, Ahmed is a rare breed. 8% of Muslims identify as Republican, according to a 2009 Gallup study. As recently as 2000, though, a number of Muslim groups endorsed George W. Bush. And to this day, many still consider themselves conservative, just no longer Republican. That's because of the rhetoric about Islam that has come from prominent Republicans, says Dalia Mogahid. She works at the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding.
If there was one Muslim issue that cuts across party affiliation, it's civil liberties.
At a halal supermarket in Virginia, I meet Umid Haja. It's right around prayer time, so you can hear the call to prayer in the background.
You know, it kind of hurts to hear what's going on in the news from a political perspective, and I'm honestly, as much as possible, I've been trying not to hear too much of it, because it affects us emotionally.
Haja remembers the days after September 11th, when George W. Bush went to a mosque and specifically said, "Islam is peace." Now Haja says candidates publicly and shamelessly bash Muslims, and that worries him.
And it just makes you wonder, gosh, am I going to be in some sort of a camp person? You know, if they're going to mark us with some, make us wear special clothes or whatever. It's just like what we did to the Japanese a while back. Is something like that going to happen again? Is it possible in these days that something like that can happen? I mean, you would think not.
But Haja says he doesn't know, and he's afraid for the America his four kids will inherit. Fahad Rahman used to vote Republican, but now he's an independent. He's disappointed with the political party he used to support.
There are very few voices that are actually saying, hey, you know, this sort of rhetoric is not helpful. It's not part of what we believe.
Rahman agrees with the GOP's economic message, but says it feels like there's no space for him in the current party. I asked him, what would it take for him to go back?
Quite frankly, to just not be a piñata for the Republican Party.
Asma Khalid, NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:18. Thanks for joining us on this Thanksgiving morning on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR. Hear more about a bill that could give student loan relief to people who relocate to rural areas. More on that story from WPR's Daniel Kading in just a few minutes.
WGTD HD2 plays jazz, big band blues, and more 24/7 on your HD radio, desktop computer, or mobile device. For access options and our new program schedule, visit WGTD.org and click HD2.
NPR production, Planet Money. Wisconsin Public Radio encourages thought-provoking conversations and ideas. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Turkey says cockpit audio supports its position that Turkish F-16 pilots repeatedly warned a Russian military jet it was violating Turkish airspace before it was shot down. Dalia Mortada reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish Armed Forces released recordings as proof that the Russian pilots did receive warning before Turkey shot down the Russian warplane for violating Turkish airspace. But the surviving Russian pilot continues to deny the signal. Ankara had already warned Moscow over past airspace violations since Russia began air operations over Syria last month.
Turkey's foreign minister says he's hopeful the incident won't hurt the country's relations with Moscow over the long term. Cheaper gasoline prices are cited as one reason more Americans are traveling over this year's Thanksgiving holiday. AAA says regular is averaging $2.05 a gallon nationwide. Here's NPR's Chris Arnold.
Prices are not down because people aren't driving. Actually, driving is up. There are more people traveling this Thanksgiving weekend compared to last year. But with the global economy a little slower than it has been, that's got demand globally down. And of course, we're bringing a lot of oil up out of the ground through fracking.
AAA says regular gas is averaging less than $2 a gallon in many states. In Alabama and South Carolina, the average is $1.83 a gallon. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A group of bipartisan lawmakers has introduced a bill that would provide student loan relief to people who relocate to rural areas. Daniel Kading has more on the Grow Wisconsin legislation.
Under the bill, the state and rural counties would pay for up to 20% of a person's outstanding student loan debt. An individual could receive at most $15,000 over 5 years. Stevens Point Democrat Senator Julie Lassa introduced the bill with Republican colleague Luther Olson. Lassa says rural areas are seeing a shortage of skilled workers.
This is one of the ways that can really help individuals pay down that loan debt while also helping local communities grow their local economies.
Lassa says the state and counties would provide matching payments of up to $1,500 each year. Counties would have to commit to offering the payments for at least 5 years if they choose to take part. Lassa says businesses or communities could also assist with paying off an individual's student debt. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Authorities say they found a person involved in the fatal shooting of a hunter near Red Granite in east central Wisconsin. Gregory Welk of Mount Morris was shot just before sunset on Monday when he hunted on his land. The 56-year-old was able to call 911 and gave investigators some information before he died at the hospital. Oshawa County Sheriff Jeff Nett said this week wardens from Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources found someone who was involved in the shooting. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Organic Valley, family farmers committed to the craft of sustainable farming, bringing Holiday Bakers organic milk, cream, butter, and eggs for over 25 years. Organic Valley, bringing the good. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to make education more affordable for students and flexible for teachers through open educational resources. Online at hewlett.org. And from Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S, with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions. At InadaUSA.com. That's InadaUSA.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. With the news that another bubble has burst, the alpaca bubble. For those of you who missed it, a few years ago, those llama-like animals were the next hot thing for hobby farms. People sank tens of thousands of dollars into top-of-the-line breeds, hoping to cash in. Then prices tanked. Luke Runyon of member station KUNC has that story.
One day about 10 years ago, Terry Holtz and his wife Dina came across a photo on the internet of a cuddly creature with a slender neck and long eyelashes.
And she says, oh, they're most adorable animals. What is it? You mean like a llama? No, they're called alpacas. There's a difference.
Holtz says initially he was skeptical about alpacas as investments.
What's the bottom line here? How are they making money? The answer was absolutely.
They decided to put a few alpacas on their 10-acre ranch outside the northern Colorado town of Wellington. At the height of the bubble, some animals were fetching hundreds of thousands of dollars at auction. The couple started breeding them and selling the offspring.
Wow, all I have to do is sell 7 of them, and I'm making more than I am at my regular job, and I only sold 7 alpacas, and it wasn't that hard to do.
The Holtzes weren't the only ones. Back in the 1980s, you'd really only find alpacas in zoos. Now there are close to 150,000 in the U.S. Their only marketable product is wool, and the high hopes for a U.S. alpaca garment industry never materialized.
The sales slowed down, the cost of hay doubled.
The value of their herd plummeted. That's why after a decade in the alpaca breeding business, they're selling out. Their Craigslist post calls it a super deal. 30 alpacas for $3,000. That's just $100 a head.
Come on, girls.
When alpacas fail to produce enough fiber to cover the cost of their hay, they sometimes wear out their welcome. And some end up here, Linda Hayes' llama and alpaca rescue outside Carbondale, Colorado.
Most of my time, rather than dealing with the animals themselves, is dealing with the phone calls and the emails, trying to put potential owners with people that want to get rid of them.
Hayes gets phone calls every week.
I've had a few that were crying. I mean, it's sad. One lady just didn't have the money. She was being evicted.
Hayes says the alpacas were often pitched to older folks, people looking to retire to a more bucolic lifestyle.
Wake up to the wonderful world of alpacas.
Even late-night TV commercials touted the animal's ability to pad a retiree's income.
We've been raising alpacas for 9 years now. I retired 2 years ago because of the alpacas, and it's just been a wonderful lifestyle.
And it was absolutely a house of cards.
Rich Sexton is an agricultural economist at the University of California, Davis.
There was never the slightest chance that it could survive and prosper.
Unless alpaca sweaters are the next hot Christmas item, there's little demand for the wool, Sexton says. Plus, Peru already has a huge alpaca fiber industry, where it's produced on a much larger scale than it is here.
These are all the females.
Alpaca rancher Terry Holtz wants to work with the wool, even after he sells his herd. He says other breeders can still sell prize-winning animals for a few thousand dollars. But it's not like it was in the heyday.
Looking back like 10 years, if you had known what you know now, would you still have bought them?
Honestly, probably not.
And Holtz says his biggest lesson in this whole thing? Take a step back before you decide to follow the herd. For NPR News, I'm Luke Runyon in Fort Collins, Colorado.
And Luke's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting collaboration that focuses on agriculture and food.
Last week, the world's top whiskey was crowned, and it was not Scotch. It was a Canadian rye made by Crown Royal. Surprisingly, not one Scotch whiskey even made it into the top five. But despite the competition, Scotch is selling better than ever in this country, as NPR's Jackie Northam discovered.
It was a tough assignment.
So you're going to have to guide me on this one. What do I want?
A lunchtime, tasting fine Scotch whiskies.
Do you normally drink whiskey? Have you had whiskey before? And do you like it peaty or smoky or not?
I settled on a Macallan rare cask for my first tasting.
Cheers to health.
Slangeva.
My guide is Richard Lockhead, a member of Scottish Parliament.
So I'm Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, Food and the Environment, and that includes food and drink, which is huge in Scotland.
Lockhead was in Washington to promote Scotland's most popular export, but it hardly seems necessary here in the US, the biggest market for Scotch whisky.
Well, Scotch whisky has grown phenomenally over the last few years, and in the US alone, there's been a massive increase in single malts in particular over the last few years.
Lockhead says that interest has helped spur nearly $3 billion worth of investment in new and refurbished distilleries in Scotland. He says while Scotch whisky is popular, the industry can't sit on its laurels because other distilleries around the world are coming after it. On the other side of town, a few days later, I caught up with Jeff Fail, the bar and spirits director for the Neighborhood Restaurant Group, which has about 15 restaurants in D.C. and Virginia. When the lunchtime crowd thins out at the Partisan restaurant, Fail and I scoot around behind the bar for a closer look. There are multiple shelves bearing whiskies from all over the world.
But the Japanese are really doing some fantastic whiskey. They really are doing some very nice, subtle flavors.
Fail says everyone is talking about a whiskey from Japan, Suntory Yamazaki, which won Whiskey of the Year last year. He says many people didn't realize Japan even made a whiskey until the movie Lost in Translation. Bill Murray's character was doing a Suntory commercial. Fail says the company creates wonderful whiskies, but the stocks are limited.
You may get a shipment once every 3 or 4 months, if you're lucky. Whereas you can, as a buyer, I can order Scotch pretty much without any sort of issue.
Fail says his restaurant group stocks many types of U.S. bourbons. He says independent bottlers are experimenting with rye, malted barley, and wheat, trying to create a distinctive taste. Fail says artisans here in the U.S. are also buying whiskey from Scotland and aging it themselves.
You can age whiskey in anything, whether it's a bourbon cask and a rum cask, bourbon and port, You have this one that's aged completely in rum cask.
Phil says that Glenlivet's, Lafroig's, and Macallan's of the world don't need to worry about being overrun by competitors anytime soon. He says only whiskey made in Scotland can be called Scotch, and there will always be a market for that. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
One interpretation of the Pilgrims' move to the New World is that they mixed their Christian beliefs with a political vision. But does that view hold up to scrutiny?
Let me tell you, this is more like Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness in many ways than it is like, let's all sit down for turkey for Thanksgiving.
Understanding the Pilgrim story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered at 3 this afternoon here on Wisconsin Public Radio or listen online at WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Linda Wertheimer. Sending out the same old greeting cards this year?
Don't be bland, don't be boring. Send a potato instead.
That's Adrian Nanchev, founder of Potato in the Post. They mail out personalized potatoes with handwritten messages. His business is trending on social media because, as he points out, if you get a potato in the mail, you tend to remember it. It's Morning Edition.
It's 8:31. Thank you for making us a part of your Thanksgiving morning. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around, because later this hour on WPR, we'll have more news from NPR and WPR. And then later today, our music will include selections from the Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts, performances by the high school band, orchestra, and choirs. You can hear that during Morning Classics from 10 until noon today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Madison, announcing a November anniversary event featuring seed cylinders, heated bird baths, and hopper feeders and trays. WBUMadison.com. Discover a refuge in your own backyard.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
Do you have accounting experience and a passion for public radio? Then you might be just who WPR is looking for to be the next financial manager for the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. You'll help provide financial stewardship of member donations. Find information about this and other WPR jobs at wpr.org/jobs. For best consideration, apply by November 30th. The University of Wisconsin Extension is an equal employment opportunity and affirmative action employer.
It'll be rainy in southeast Wisconsin today. There'll be a sleet and snow mixture changing over to snow in northwestern Wisconsin this afternoon. Highs near 40, a bit warmer near Lake Michigan. For tonight, snow in northwestern Wisconsin and rain in the southeast in the evening. A sleet and snow mixture in central Wisconsin will turn to snow, and sleet and freezing rain drizzle are expected in northwest Wisconsin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation. Expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant making and social investing. More at Kresge.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org. And from the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Here is a penny for your thoughts. Do we really need pennies? Just a little something to contemplate on this holiday morning. Here's NPR's Chris Arnold.
Is it finally time to get rid of the penny? The question was put to the top currency official in the country this week. That's after comedian John Oliver took a swing at pennies on his TV show.
2% of Americans admitted to regularly throwing pennies in the garbage, which means the U.S. Mint is spending millions to make garbage.
Of course, more people just let them pile up in drawers or in jars, and that's why...
One study found that 2/3 of pennies don't circulate, and yet the penny hangs around for no reason, like the appendix or the new Muppets TV show. How is this still on?
It actually costs more than a penny to make a penny, so the government's losing money on that deal.
It costs roughly 2 cents to make each penny.
Jeff Gore is a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He says last year the U.S. Mint made about 8 billion pennies at a cost of $132 million. And Gore says you also have to consider the time that people waste fumbling for pennies at the cash register.
That's right. There are essentially no benefits associated with using the penny, yet there are significant costs.
So Gore doesn't like pennies, and he actually maintains a website that's called retirethepenny.org. It urges the government to get rid of pennies. And a few years ago, that got him on television with another comedian, Stephen Colbert.
What about Lincoln, sir?
Yes.
How is this in any way different than going back and re-assassinating Abraham Lincoln? Well, you might as well build a time machine and sneak up behind him with your anti... You might as well shoot him in the head with a penny.
I like to think that it's a little bit different, and it's important to remember the...
Give me one way in which it's different.
Well, the $5 bill is, will still feature Lincoln, and eventually we may be
able
to...
Until you get to it.
And actually, most Americans seem to side with Colbert on this. Polls have shown that most people want to keep the little copper-colored coin. Francois Veldy is an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago.
American society is very innovative and forward-looking in many ways, but in a few other dimensions, we tend to be quite conservative. And interestingly, the currency is one of those areas. You look at the design of our currency, it's been the same dead presidents on the bills, on the coins for almost a century, and we're rather attached to that, I think.
Now, some people worry that getting rid of pennies could push prices up by a few cents, but Veldy says you might get a one-time tiny little blip if prices rose at all. He says Canada ditched the penny recently and didn't have any problems. This week, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew said that the government is reviewing a proposal to stop making the penny. But Veldy says actually he has an even better proposal. Nickels cost 5 times as much as pennies to make. So
you just abandon the nickel and just declare that all the pennies are worth 5 cents.
But that would take an act of Congress, so don't hold your breath. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Whether you haul out pennies, dollars, or plastic, chances are you will be buying gifts in the next days and weeks. But where will you buy and why? We reached analyst Liz Dunn to discuss current retail trends. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We always seem to start the holiday shopping season with a little uneasiness, especially in the last few years. Do you think this is going to be a better year for retail?
I don't think it's going to be a particularly good year for retail. I think the consumer's in decent shape, but they just really aren't voting for stuff. They're looking to buy experiences, travel, restaurants, Broadway shows. And so I think it will be a difficult holiday season for retailers.
So what would your advice be to department stores and other retailers? What should they do if that's the trend?
I think the most important thing that retailers can do right now is really try to capture some sort of, theatrical experience almost inside their four walls. Try to do things that delight and excite the consumer and make shopping more fun. I think consumers are focused on anything that they can Instagram, anything that they can sort of report back to their networks of social media. And so the more exciting the shopping experience, the better, and the more likely that consumers will end up in your store to spend those limited holiday dollars.
Do you have any idea what these people are thinking about when they think theatrical experience? What is that?
It's the store environment, obviously all the decorations, but it's bringing more drama into the store environment and changing that environment as you go through the season. And so it's no longer enough to set the store with one holiday look and then leave that for the entire duration of the season. I think any kind of appearances by celebrities or appearances by designers, all of that really kind of contributes to the drama and the theater of retail.
My favorite shopping experience is finding someone to wait on me.
Service is definitely a big factor for consumers this year. And I think that what we're seeing many retailers do is cut down on the number of associates, but really highlight the best associates. And so we saw that with Victoria's Secret and L Brands recently this year, where they say they're going to be paying fewer people more money, really emphasizing the best sales associates to deliver that best service.
One trend that seems to be getting some pushback this year is stores being open on Thanksgiving. REI got a lot of attention for announcing that they would close, not only on the holiday, but on Black Friday as well. Does this mean we're headed back for non-commercial, traditional Thanksgiving?
Unfortunately, no. There has definitely been some backlash about the Thanksgiving openings, but for the most part, it looks to be here to stay. The openings play really well with the millennial consumer. They want to eat dinner and then, you know, leave. So
skip washing the dishes somehow.
Yeah, get out of washing the dishes, exactly. And every retailer is trying to capture that younger consumer. There's a little bit of nostalgia to it as well that's not completely lost on the millennial consumer. Something about going to a mall is a little bit tongue-in-cheek interesting because, you know, we don't really shop that way anymore. So I think there are two parts of it, but I also think that consumer is likely wanting to get away from the Thanksgiving table and have another activity to do after dinner.
Liz Dunn, thank you very much for joining us, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Liz Dunn is a brand analyst, and her consulting firm is Talmadge Advisors. This is NPR News.
It's 8:41, and you're tuned in to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR, and then in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report. In the first half of this year alone, the toy industry grew by 6.5%, or $400 million. That's according to the NPD Group, which tracks sales. That group says this could be the best year for toy sales in a decade. That story in 10 minutes.
Hi, this is John Munson, looking forward to spending 10 days next summer touring the Canadian Rockies by rail with Holiday Vacations and WPR listeners. We'll explore Vancouver, Lake Louise, and the Columbia Icefield, Banff, Calgary, and more. We'll discover the wilderness of the Rockies and the beauty of the Bouchard Gardens. Airfare, hotels, and many meals are included. The trip leaves June 15th. Details available now at wpr.org/travel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. British Prime Minister David Cameron is calling on lawmakers in his country to expand the military's airstrikes against ISIS targets in Iraq to ones in Syria. NPR's Peter Kenyon says this comes nearly 2 weeks after deadly terror attacks in Paris.
In 2013, Parliament backed anti-ISIS airstrikes in Iraq, but not in Syria. After the Paris attacks, Cameron says if Britain isn't prepared to act now, some may wonder if it ever will be. A vote on whether to approve airstrikes in Syria could come next week, with critics warning that Britain shouldn't get sucked into a war with no clear resolution in sight.
Authorities in Austria say they've identified nearly all of the 71 migrants found dead in the back of a truck abandoned along a highway 3 months ago. As Carrie Skyring reports from Vienna, most were from Iraq and Afghanistan.
The migrants died of asphyxiation in a sealed refrigerated truck abandoned by the human traffickers they'd paid to take them to Western Europe. Five men are facing charges in Hungary in connection with the deaths. This tragedy led to a crackdown on people smuggling, but also to a major change in the way migrants fleeing conflict are treated. After entering Europe, most are now transported by government trains and buses rather than people smugglers.
There is no trading today on Wall Street because of the Thanksgiving holiday. The markets will be open in a shortened trading session on Black Friday. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Children under 10 years old would be able to hunt next year if a bill pending in the legislature wins approval. Gilman Halstead reports.
Under the bill, sponsored by Representative Joel Clayfish of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin would join 40 other states that allow parents to decide at what age their children are ready to carry a gun or a bow when hunting with a parent or guardian. Clayfish says studies show lifting the current 10-year-old age requirement for mentored hunting won't lead to more hunting accidents.
There are fewer incidences of accidents during the hunting season than with the average license holder. Overall, mentored hunting is safer.
The bill faces opposition from some hunting instructors who say the current age restriction is similar to those for voting, driving, and drinking and shouldn't be changed. They say the bill should be approved by the Conservation Congress this spring before lawmakers vote on it. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Forecasters say a snowstorm that hammered south-central Wisconsin over the weekend might cause flooding over the Thanksgiving holiday. The National Weather Service says a combination of heavy rain and melting snow in the area could cause rivers to rapidly rise tonight and into tomorrow to above flood stage. Rivers most susceptible to rapid rises, forecasters say, include the Pecatonica and Fox Rivers. The Wisconsin State Journal reports temperatures are expected to continue to rise ahead of an approaching cold front coming soon. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security, at Cigna.com. And from the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the passion of NPR journalists all around the world whose stories take us there every day.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Britain's last deep coal mine will be closing in a few weeks' time. It marks the death of a centuries-old industry that helped fuel the Industrial Revolution and build an empire. But power stations are now buying cheaper fuel from abroad, and British coal miners say they feel betrayed by their government. NPR's Leila Fadel visited that last mine.
The parking lot of Kellingley Colliery in northern Yorkshire is almost empty. A solitary miner leans out from the top of one of the buildings. In its heyday, Kellingley employed more than 2,500 people. But on December 18th, this mine will close. Chris Kitchen, the General Secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers, meets us just outside the mine.
There just doesn't seem to be a political will to do anything to assist coal.
Kitchen is dressed in a three-piece suit. He wears a button from the miner strike in the 1980s.
So it seems like all the basic foundation industries that you would need to rebuild a manufacturing economy, the UK government's just not interested in protecting and are prepared to see them go to the wall, because in essence they're trying to run a country like a business, and you cannot run a country like a business.
Standing nearby is Keith Paulson. He's one of the last miners in an industry that once employed over a million people. When he loses his job at the end of the year, he'll be 55.
What's going to happen to us? Basically, we've been thrown onto the scrap heap. Why are we doing this? Why are we smashing our industries? You can't understand it. You can't understand it.
Britain was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, and now it's come full circle. Like in other developed countries, Britain is closing its coal mines and turning to cheap imports and alternative energy. Julian Hoppett, a historian at University College London, says Kellingley is a symbol of the death of industry in Britain.
The closure of the last mine is the closure of a long episode in British history.
Britain led the world in manufacturing in the 1700s and 1800s, using coal to power steam engines and heat homes. But in the 20th century, as labor costs grew and coal became more and more expensive to dig up, Britain, like most developed economies, couldn't compete on the global market. In the 1980s, then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher went after the coal miners' union.
There's a sense in which the crucial moment was under Margaret Thatcher's government, when she took on the trade unions, the mining unions, and tried and succeeded to force market pressures to work much more directly upon the way the industry worked.
Today, Britain is only dependent on manufacturing for about 10% of its economy, and the scars of the closures are apparent. Back in northern England, 20 miles from Kellingley, lies the former mining town of Goldthorpe. In 2013, people burned an effigy of Thatcher when she died. They blamed her for killing the coal industry and this once buzzing mining town. Most storefronts in Goldthorpe are shuttered. The streets are quiet. At a local pub, the afternoon drinkers are mostly former miners. Peter Cooper chats with friends over a pint. He lost his mining job in 1987.
Within a 10-mile radius of this village, there were 17 coal mines. It's crucified the place. You've seen it, haven't you? There's nothing here. Nobody's in work.
These men say that the coal industry kept Britain fighting through two world wars. And now, they say the country has forgotten them. Leila Faldin, NPR News, London.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Marketplace Morning Report is up next, and then in 10 minutes, it's classical music. Norman Gilliland is in for Stephanie Elkins today. Join him for Morning Classics at 9. Today's music selections come from the Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts. Then at noon, a special program of music and stories for Thanksgiving. That's here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
Featuring the UW Jazz Orchestra. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support jazz education and performance. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
It'll be rainy in southeastern Wisconsin today with a sleet and snow mix, changing over to snow in northwestern Wisconsin by the afternoon. Highs near 40, except a bit warmer, near 50 around Lake Michigan.
Support for WPR comes from True Endeavors, presenting Tommy Emmanuel, Classics and Christmas Tour at Shannon Hall in Madison, December 4th. The guitar virtuoso plays solo fan favorites and new arrangements on Yuletide Classics.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Artist Gallery on Main Street in downtown Racine is hosting a unique interactive exhibit titled Please Handle the Dolls. They call it Contemporary Soft Sculpture, on exhibit through the end of the year. For more, visit artistgalleryracine.com.
A day that should be quiet for business turns kind of rowdy.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the United States Postal Service, offering Holiday Forever stamps at local retailers. Supermarkets, drugstores, wholesale clubs, and office supply stores sell Holiday Forever stamps. Marketplace's coverage of wealth and poverty issues is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. More at fordfoundation.org.
Happy Thanksgiving from Marketplace in New York. I'm Mark Garrison, in for David Brancaccio. Wall Street may be quiet for the Thanksgiving holiday, but around the world, trading is hot. In Europe, markets are up. More on that when we do the numbers. But first, let's get the big picture with Michael Eusen, Chief Market Analyst at CMC Markets in London. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
So next week, we have a European Central Bank meeting. We have some sense of what investors expect based on trading today. But what are you looking for out of the ECB next week?
We're expecting some form of easing from the ECB, maybe a cut in the deposit rate or an extension of quantitative easing. The markets are certainly pricing that in. I think the concern is overall that markets are expecting way too much, certainly in the context of what the ECB can do collectively and what they will deliver. But overall, optimism fairly high, equity markets are higher, and the euro is lower.
So here in the U.S., we have widespread anticipation of a Fed rate hike coming soon. We have the busy holiday retail season kicking off tomorrow. What are investors in Europe paying most attention to in America?
Overall, I think they'll be looking to see how the U.S. consumer reacts over the Black Friday, Cyber Monday holiday weekend. Personal spending has been a little bit on the weak side over the past couple of months, and I think they'll be looking for a pickup there. That could well influence the Fed decision. Expectations are high that we're going to get a rate hike, which does beg the question is, will the Fed disappoint? But overall, I think markets have got used to the idea the Fed is going to raise and the ECB is going to ease.
Okay, Michael Eusen at CMC Markets in London. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are up around the world. In Germany, up 1.2%, in the UK up nearly 0.7%, and up 1% in France. Asian markets closed mixed. Wall Street is on a break for Thanksgiving, as we know. Yesterday was the last full day of trading for the week. Stocks didn't move all that much. The S&P 500 closed just a hair below where it started at 2088. The Dow didn't move much, finishing up a little bit at 17,813. And the NASDAQ closed up 0.25% at 5116. The dispute over Turkey shooting down a Russian fighter jet is having new economic consequences. Russia is now cracking down on Turkish food imports. The two countries disagree about whether the plane was over Turkish or Syrian land when it was shot down. The dispute highlights concerns about whether Russia's military expansion will hurt its overall economy. Olga Oliker is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Countries whose economies are not in terribly good shape get involved in spending on their militaries all the time. They're making a choice, right? They're not investing in other things that they could be investing their very limited resources in when they spend the money on wars and on guns. This is clearly a choice Russia is making, and at a time of economic difficulty, economic recession, I think it's clear that this is going to hurt other parts of the economy and other sorts of government spending.
All this comes as French President François Hollande meets Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow today.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Avalara, tax automation for businesses of all sizes. Avalara works to simplify sales tax and other business taxes with real-time rates and automatic filing. Learn more at avalara.com, avalara.com. And by Epson, innovating receipt printers used in grocery stores, department stores, and restaurants throughout the world. Where there's business, there's Epson. And by Kronos, with cloud-based workforce management solutions designed for organizations to maximize their most valued asset, their workforce. Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
Athletic apparel company Under Armour wants the world to know it's getting serious about sneakers, too. That's why it's opening a big design office right in Nike's backyard. That's also near the North American headquarters of Adidas. It turns out the big winner in the fight for the $20 billion footwear market is the city of Portland. John Sepulveda of Oregon Public Broadcasting explains.
Ghostworks is a top shoe design shop. And if you want to get an idea of just how competitive the sneaker business is in Portland, just ask Ghostworks founder, Eirik Nielsen, which companies he works for.
I'm not sure if we can say that to your listeners, but and I can talk you through some of this, but some are here in town.
Basically, Nielsen explains that industry secrecy is a huge deal. That's because a lost design or a slip about insider information could kill a sneaker rollout worth millions of dollars.
What we do here will affect the bottom line of the company. We are looking out into the future, and all of our clients want to get there first.
That competitiveness in the industry also drives a lot of good works in the Portland metro region. Like when Adidas helped pay to build a soccer park in a city neighborhood that didn't have one before.
From an economic standpoint, the sneaker market, the sportswear industry overall is growing, and that has an inevitable impact in the Portland community at large.
Simon Atkins is the brand director for Adidas USA. And while the charitable works are part community do-gooding, there may be some corporate one-upmanship going on as well. Take Under Armour. The new player in town recently paid the city of Portland more than $5 million to renovate a park that used to be maintained by Nike. Meanwhile, Atkins says the competition to be the best also creates a lot of jobs.
We're growing considerably in Adidas America. And we give you an example. You go online today, we're looking at over 80 open jobs to hire here within Adidas alone, with further plans in 2016 to grow even further. Look at occupancy here, about 98% occupancy here in this building. We're growing.
And sneaker industry jobs pay well. Take designers. They can make as much as six figures. Although I couldn't pin down exactly how much they make, the designers I spoke with kept that, like almost everything else, a secret. In Portland, I'm John Sepulveda for Marketplace.
And finally, if you want to play Adele during the Thanksgiving holiday, don't expect to find her music on just any streaming service. It's not going to be on Spotify or Apple Music for now, but she is on Pandora, news of which gave its stock a bit of a lift. Other than that, you may actually just have to buy the music. music, if you remember how to do that. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you're listening to WPR, that's Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, happy Thanksgiving. I'm Norman Gilliland, in for Stephanie Elkins today, and we'll have some special programming for the day, quite a variety of it to look forward to, starting in just a few seconds at 9 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Fromagination on Madison's Capitol Square, a locally owned source for Wisconsin artisanal cheeses and gourmet gifts. More about their custom catering and nationwide holiday shipping is at fromagination.com.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
You're listening.